I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is democracynow.org.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
This month, June 12th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton presents Satyricon, Madness and Glory. Mike Laster's documentary about the world-famous punk club Satyricon that opened in 1983, featuring interviews and footage from the Old Town establishment. Immediately following the film, 20-Foot Man, Portland's own very large musical steel puppet, a mainstay of public art, will perform myth formations emanating from written and unwritten musical concepts, arranged for your listening and viewing pleasure. Again, June 12th, the documentary film Madness and Glory, followed by a live performance from 20-Foot Man at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton. More information about KBOO at the Clinton this month and every second Thursday can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. Free 'Em All is an evening of music, dance, spoken word, and political remix featuring David Rovex, international folk singer-songwriter, and emceed by KBOO's own Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th, 7 p.m. at Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll get a report on yesterday's attack by the Taliban on a major airport in Pakistan.
For the first time in decades, a majority of Americans oppose the death penalty.
And workers are organizing for living wages at Walmart.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 9th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. The Oregon Army National Guard plans to deploy approximately 180 soldiers to Kuwait in support of the U.S. occupation known by the name Operation Enduring Freedom. According to a spokesperson for the National Guard, the soldiers will spend 9 months on carpentry, plumbing, and electrical construction on U.S. military facilities throughout Kuwait and the surrounding region. The soldiers are all from the National Guard's 234th Engineer Company, which is based near Warrenton, Oregon. The 234th Engineers previously deployed to Iraq from July 2007 to April 2008, where they conducted security operations for civilian contractor convoys. Last week, Oregon Army National Guard troops were also called up to serve in Afghanistan beginning later this month. The troops will provide security and support for military facilities in Kabul and southwestern Afghanistan. That marks the third time that the 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team has been mobilized to Afghanistan.
A Hillsborough resident has filed a federal lawsuit claiming that he was racially profiled when he was illegally stopped and beaten by Hillsborough police. Jermaine Robinson, a 41-year-old African-American, was riding his bicycle in June 2012 when he was stopped by Hillsborough police officers Will Blood and Brian Wilbur. Robinson claims he asked the officers what he did wrong, but they didn't answer. According to the complaint, Blood and Wilbur grabbed Robinson, threw him off his bike, and tasered him twice. They then handcuffed Robinson and took him to the Hillsborough County Jail. The lawsuit claims that the officers' treatment of Robinson resulted from racial profiling. Robinson was charged and then later acquitted on charges of resisting arrest. He was, however, found guilty of 3 bike violations. The lawsuit seeks damages from the 2 officers and the city of Hillsborough and asked for injunctive relief against the city that would require a policy preventing illegal profiling.
Health risks from air pollution in the Portland metro area remain a problem that impacts people throughout the city. A workshop about air pollution was held last Friday in North Portland. It was led by State Senator Michael Dembro and Representative Mitch Greenlick. The focus was toxics in the air and the impacts on public health. Various health and environmental departments gave data about toxics such as lead, diesel, and fine dust particles. Individuals and citizen groups at risk from air pollution expressed their worries. Topics included pollution from traffic, industry, and airports, and sources such as freeways, the Intel Corporation, and Hillsboro Airport. KBOO's David Lang was there to record some of the highlights of that meeting.
The Clean Air Act establishes ambient air quality concentrations for each of these pollutants. And states are required to monitor for these pollutants and determine areas that do not meet the federal standard. Even though that we're meeting the standards for all these criteria pollutants, we are not in the clear for ozone or for fine particulate. EPA is looking at the ozone standard and may lower that standard. They're actually planning to lower that standard based on new science about the health impacts of ozone. If that standard is lowered low enough, by as soon as next year, Portland could be in non-attainment for ozone again. Also for fine particulates, EPA recently lowered the particulate standard. It actually came out with a new standard for the smallest particulates. And it's now more of a challenge to meet that standard. And looking at that map, you can see that there is the highest concentration, as you would expect, along major roadways with a lot of traffic. You can even see that there's the network of freeways in the Portland area in the highest risk. Turns out that the highest risk is about 500 yards of a freeway, and then the risk drops off dramatically after that. You also see from this map with all the red that vehicles are a large contributor to air toxics in the Portland area.
EPA estimates, even at 40 years after the passage of the Clean Air Act, that on average, national average, approximately 1 in every 20,000 people have an increased likelihood of contracting cancer as a result of breathing air toxics. DEQ goes on to estimate that diesel emissions alone in Oregon account for 390 deaths a year. To understand that number, that's more than the combined total of drunk driving and homicide in our state. So when we just say that the air is cleaner than the 1970s, it's like saying our cities are safer from crime, which is true, but it isn't to say that it's an excuse for taking further action. We believe the DEQ could have the funding it needs to ensure that communities are protected by regulated sources of air pollution. Up to this point, relying almost exclusively on permit fees, the air program barely has the resources to meet its most basic function of assisting regulated sources come into compliance with federal requirements. The Intel permit fiasco begs the question if current funding is adequate to meet even that standard, as the agency recently determined that Intel's facility was found to be out of compliance for nearly a decade.
You know, one of the things that we heard earlier is that we've made a lot of progress in reducing lead from the air thanks to eliminating lead from our motor vehicle gas. But it continues to be a problem, apparently, with general aviation gas. And so this is a new one for me, and I look forward to hearing more about this.
EPA National Emissions Inventory reveals that airports are major facility sources of a number of toxic emissions. And in Oregon, it's important to keep in mind there are 457 airports in this state, most of which emit lead. Many of these pollutants are linked with negative health outcomes. They're the toxins that were already discussed, so I won't belabor this point, but increased risk of autism, ADHD, cardiovascular disease, and a number of other very serious health ailments. So now we'll move into the Hillsborough Airport. This facility, the Hillsborough Airport, is the number one facility source of lead, ethylene, butadiene, ethylbenzene, formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, particulate matter in the entire county and all of Washington County. Number two source of nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and PM2.5, third largest source of volcanic volatile organic compounds. Significant impact on the community. It emits more lead than any other facility in the state. It ranks nationwide. It's number it's 21st out of 20,000 airports in the country in lead emissions. And it's the piston engine general aviation aircraft. Jets do not use leaded fuel. They do emit other toxins, but they don't use leaded fuel. More than half of all airborne lead emissions in this country are from piston engine aircraft. Now, this figure is quite interesting. The U.S. has more, nearly three times as many lead-emitting piston engine aircraft, 167,000 versus 63,000 for the rest of the world. Hmm. Why is that? Why does the U.S. need so many of these aircraft? Particularly in light of lead emissions and other toxins. And here's some of the reasons why it's of concern with children. Once you detect lead, it's kind of too late. It's already in the tissues. It's already in the brain. The impacts are thought to be irreversible. It's linked with just some, you know, lower IQs, learning problems, just a host of health issues. And keeping in mind that Hillsborough is surrounded on three sides by residential community, on the fourth side by farmland. Lead doesn't vaporize, by the way. It goes into the soil. It remains there for reuptake in your plants, so our food supply is probably tainted pretty significantly with lead.
Good morning. I'm Jim Lubisher. I'm a pediatrician. 85% of my toddlers have lead in their blood. The average level is 1,200 nanograms. Normal should be about 16. As noted before, the number one facility source of lead in Oregon is the Hillsborough Airport, the activity thereof. In 2005, the CDC stated no level of lead in a child's blood can be specified as safe. In 2012, the CDC stated no safe blood level has been identified. Last year, the EPA stated there is no evidence of a threshold below which there are no harmful effects on cognition from lead exposure. That is a stunning statement. This suggests that any lead in a child can adversely affect their IQ. Lead is what scientists call the xenobiotic, a foreign substance with no useful role in human physiology, toxic even in minute quantities. And I would just point out that Hillsborough Airport has a lot more activity. All airports monitored have lead in their air. I would suggest that Oregon, taking lead in the nation, lower the ambient air quality standard for lead and reduce it to what some consider the pristine level. In 1969, the environmentalist Rene Dubois warned, "The problem is so well defined, so neatly packaged, with both causes and cures known, that if we don't eliminate the social crime, our society deserves all the disasters that have been forecast for it." Excuse me.
The proceeding was a workshop on toxic air pollution and public health held at the PCC Cascades campus last Friday.
That hearing was called Toxics in the Air. It was held in Portland. The Intel Corporation in Hillsboro was one of the topics discussed at that hearing. That company was recently fined nearly $150,000 for emissions of fluoride, an ozone-depleting toxin.
This Wednesday, the Portland Water Bureau will hold the second of two public meetings on the proposed Mount Tabor Reservoir Project. The public's invited to attend, ask questions, and provide feedback on the proposed Mount Tabor Park project. The meeting takes place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Warner Pacific College, 2219 Southeast 68th Avenue in the McGuire Auditorium. The public meetings focus on the proposed work to cover the open reservoirs. In order to satisfy an unfunded federal water quality mandate, Portland's required to disconnect the city's open-air reservoirs, including three at Mount Tabor Park. The work is planned to begin in early 2015. The first of the two public meetings was held last month. For more information, visit the Portland Water Bureau Public Information website on portlandoregon.gov.
The Oregon Humane Society announced today that they found homes for 231 pets last week. This is a record number of pets adopted by people in the Portland area and points to the success of a recent ad campaign by the Humane Society encouraging pet adoption. The fortunate group of pets includes Guinness, one of the Humane Society's longest resident cats.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Amy Atwood with the Center for Biological Diversity. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline, with a discussion of a recent Willamette Week article exploring the possibility that Oregon may not incarcerate youth at a high enough rate. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be around 49 degrees with a slight chance of rain. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 73. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 30 counts per minute in North Portland and Eugene, 29 counts per minute in both Vancouver and Hanford, Washington. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. And on this day in history, the first ballistic missile-carrying submarine, the USS George Washington, was launched in 1959.
Time is 5:17. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
At last, our political leaders in Washington are taking action for low-wage workers and the middle class, striking a blow for America's historic value of economic fairness. Gosh, I hope you don't think I meant Washington, D.C. No, no, the same old corporate mentality of stripping any semblance of ethics from the work ethic still rules in that plutocratic roost. Rather than D.C., it's Washington State I'm talking about, specifically the progressive forces of Seattle, who've just produced a landmark $15 an hour minimum wage. Instead of just talking about the widening gap of inequality and wishing Congress might give a damn about the millions of Americans being knocked down, the people of Seattle are providing national leadership. "We did it. Workers did this," Shama Sawant said, a member of Occupy Seattle. She's been the tenacious, articulate leader of a large grassroots coalition of low-wage workers called 15 Now, and she was elected to the city council last year by building the case for a $15 wage floor. In addition, Mayor Ed Murray campaigned last year for raising the minimum to $15, indexed to inflation, and this year he pulled together a 24-member working group of labor and business interests, which has spent 4 months hammering out details of the local ordinance. On June 2nd, all 9 city council members voted to adopt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the forces of corporate greed never sleep. And a Washington, D.C. group called the International Franchise Association is unleashing a pack of lawyers to sue the city, hoping a federal judge will nullify the will of local voters. So the political fight is not over. But the good people of Seattle have done all of us a big favor by moving the wage debate from the miserly, self-centered turf of the corporate bottom line to the moral high ground of social justice, where it belongs. Seattle is just the start of this movement.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we turn to our friends at nativenews.net for the top headlines across the country from an indigenous perspective.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Conference kicked off Sunday in Anchorage. Jocelyn Estes is the news director with KNBA in Anchorage. Jocelyn, what's on the agenda for NCAI?
A lot of the sessions have to do with tribal governance, land and resource management, housing, health, transportation, education. And there are sessions on issues like violence against women, food security, and handling the effects of climate change. NCAI's mid-year conference basically is the time for tribes to get together and tackle some of these big issues to develop strategies and adopt resolutions that set priorities and set direction for NCAI.
What are some of the top issues Alaska tribes are addressing?
One of the big issues for tribes here is that the state of Alaska does not recognize tribes. It does not recognize the right of tribes to manage their own affairs in certain areas and the need to consult with tribes as governing bodies on issues. And this plays out in a lot of different arenas. For instance, right now in court, the state of Alaska is fighting with tribes over translating election materials, which is an issue. It has to do with voting rights. And the tribes are repeatedly in court against the state to try to establish, defend, or protect their right to manage Indian child welfare, which is pretty much a management issue in other states, I think, that states accept the right of tribes to manage. One of the biggest issues is subsistence, food that is gathered from the land and shared with family and community members. And there are two fish and game management systems in Alaska, federal and state. The federal fish and game management managers recognize subsistence as a priority use, and the state doesn't. And there are other big issues, the lack of clean water and sanitation in dozens of villages, high rates of suicide, and so on.
That was Jocelyn Estes with KNBA. Tune in this week for more coverage about NCAI.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
According to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, a majority of Americans favor life without parole as an alternative to the death penalty for those convicted of murder. While a majority of 60% still support capital punishment in general, the percentage in favor of execution is 42% when mandatory life sentences are included as an alternative option. Overall support for the death penalty has declined from a high of 80% in 1994 and has decreased steadily in recent years as the number of convictions overturned due to new evidence has grown. In addition, public attention brought to botched executions, like the case of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma this past April, as well as cases like Troy Davis in Georgia, in which an innocent man was executed, has helped spur the decline in support for execution. Many states have responded to this development by tightening secrecy provisions in their execution procedures so that problems like these can be concealed from the public.
A number of states are considering alternative methods of execution. as the lethal injection method comes under scrutiny following several botched executions. Another problem with lethal injections is that the poisons used to kill the prisoners have become harder to obtain. One pharmaceutical company based in Europe decided last year to stop selling the necessary drug to U.S. states if it would be used to execute people. No country in Europe has the death penalty anymore, and 80% of countries around the world have abolished the death penalty as well. In the U.S., the death penalty was abolished in 1972, but was reinstated by a Supreme Court decision in 1976 that allowed for the death penalty as long as the methods used were not cruel and unusual. After an execution in Oklahoma in April that took over 20 minutes of excruciating pain for the inmate to die, and a similar botched execution in Ohio, many states have begun to question the method of execution, if not the death penalty itself. A poll of Americans last week found that, for the first time in decades, a majority of those polled were against the death penalty when offered an alternative punishment of life without parole. Without this alternative, the majority of those polled were in favor of the death penalty. In Utah, the state legislature will consider a bill to change the preferred method of execution to the firing squad. And several states are considering laws to change the method of execution from lethal injection to the gas chamber.
The upsurge in labor activism among low-wage workers continued over the last week with a series of staff walkouts against Walmart, held in 20 cities across the U.S. The strikes were led by Our Walmart, an independent group of Walmart employees. The Walmart workers are calling for an hourly wage increase to at least $13 an hour, which is the amount that Walmart management publicly claims that most workers receive. In truth, the average wage at Walmart is $8.81 per hour, since most stores are required to reduce payroll by relying on part-time workers. At Walmart's annual shareholders meeting on Friday, it was confirmed that despite sales growth of less than 2%, Walmart's top executives would receive bonuses following, quote, pay-related adjustments. The Walmart employee actions follow last month's protests of fast food workers in New York City, Boston, and Philadelphia, calling for an increase in the hourly national minimum wage to at least $15, and the recent move by the Seattle City Council to increase the minimum wage to $15 within 3 years.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
For Doug Cunningham, I'm Joanne Powers. Since the Illinois state legislature recognized home health care workers as public employees in 2003, union membership for the industry has improved wages, quality of care, and workplace safety. But now a case before the U.S. Supreme Court has public employee unions holding their breath. In 2010, the rapidly anti-union National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation filed a case on behalf of workers who did not want to pay a small fair share fee to the union, even though they have benefited from union-negotiated contracts. The court is expected to hand down a decision soon, possibly even later today. Eileen Boris of the University of California Santa Barbara Department of Feminist Studies says this case is taking a group of workers who are not even recognized as workers by some and using them to undermine all public employee unionism.
Trade unions have been one of the major forces mobilizing people against the right-wing assault on U.S. democracy and worker rights. If it gets rid of everything, then right to work will be the law of the land. Public employees' unions would be required by law to bargain for people that don't have to pay them anything, and they'd be crippled to be political players. In essence, it would destroy the power of public employee unionism.
By the power vested in me by the state of Wisconsin, I now pronounce you lawfully wedded spouses. You may kiss.
A federal judge on Friday struck down Wisconsin's 8-year-old ban on same-sex marriage, saying it violated the equal protection provisions of the U.S. Constitution. While the state plans to appeal the decision, county clerks in both Milwaukee and the state capital of Madison worked late Friday night to issue marriage licenses for hundreds of same-sex couples. New statistics from the U.S. Department of Labor show that wages for American workers continue to stagnate while the benefits of a growing economy flow to the wealthiest 1%. Even though the recession officially ended 6 years ago, income for the majority of American families has rebounded far less and more slowly than in the 3 years following the Great Depression of the 1930s, with wages failing to keep pace with inflation. Heidi Shierholz, labor market economist with the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute.
We see two indicators that are doing really great, corporate profits and the stock market. And neither of those things matter to the vast majority of households. Less than half of households in this country have any money at all in the stock market. Jobs and wages, those things have been doing abysmally in the last decade. Because the top has captured so much of the growth over the last 35 years, there is simply less for everyone else.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A judge in England today heard testimony in the case of a number of female activists who were spied upon by male police officers who impersonated activists and involved the women in intimate relationships lasting for months and even years in some cases. The activists were involved in the animal rights movement and anarchist scene in England. They were spied on for over a decade by three undercover officers who befriended the activists and started relationships with women in the movement. Jason Kirkpatrick is one of the activists who was spied upon.
I grew up under sunny Southern California skies amongst a big patriotic and God-fearing family. I was taught that one day I might have to go to war to defend democracy. Somewhere along the way, I developed my own definition of what that means to me. I became a student activist, was elected to local city council, became a vice mayor, and was politically active at an international level. I went to Europe and ended up moving to Berlin. I took leading roles in environmental and anti-globalization movements, but at some point, it seemed that the police had begun targeting me.
Hello, my name is Jason Kirkpatrick, and I'm directing a film called Spied Upon. A couple of years ago, I found out that a very dear friend of mine was actually not a dear friend. He was a British undercover policeman who'd been spying on me over a number of years. It turns out that this spy, Mark Kennedy, had spied on people across Europe and in the USA, mainly environmentalists and social justice campaigners. In the news every day, we read about spy scandals, whether it's the NSA, the CIA, spying in England, Germany, what have you. But what we don't hear is the personal stories of those who've been targeted by such undercover operations. What I'm doing with Spied Upon is allowing a viewer to get a human sense of what that experience is actually like, which can at times be terrifying.
That was activist and filmmaker Jason Kirkpatrick. His new film is called Spied Upon. Kirkpatrick and others were tricked into befriending Mark Kennedy, an undercover British police officer. Before being exposed, Kennedy went into business spying on activists and later was employed by a U.S.-based private security firm called the Densis Group. After being fired from the police, he relocated to Cleveland, Ohio. He has since again relocated to Los Angeles, California, where he claims that he's advising the L.A. County Sheriff's Department.
The Karachi Jinnah International Airport came under attack yesterday by militants from the Taliban movement of Pakistan. 10 attackers broke through a security checkpoint in a van and attacked the cargo terminal of the airport with automatic weapons, hand grenades, rocket-propelled grenades, and other explosives. They were wearing uniforms of the airport security force and had used fake IDs to enter the airport. A senior Pakistani intelligence official said some of the militants tried to hijack a plane but were unsuccessful. The attackers were reported to have initially seized control of the airport tarmac and runways. Within hours, 8 of the 10 militants were shot dead by the army commandos, and the remaining 2 blew themselves up when they were cornered. The siege officially ended after 5 hours. 31 people, including the 10 terrorists, were killed in the incident. At least 18 security personnel were also injured in the attack and hospitalized.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Monday, June 9, 2014. Israeli troops open fire at Palestinian homes in Gaza and kidnap civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers stationed across the eastern borders of Gaza City fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition, targeting a number of homes and farmlands east of the Ash-Shuja'iyah neighborhood east of Gaza City. Local news sources announced that Israeli troops stationed near the Karnei crossing fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition, targeting several homes, agricultural land, causing damage but no injuries. The army alleged that a homemade shell fired from Gaza landed near the border fence in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The army frequently targets farmers and workers in their own land in area close to the borders in the northern and eastern parts of the Gaza Strip, causing excessive property damage and dozens of casualties. Also on Monday, Israel allowed the entry of 280 trucks into the besieged Gaza Strip. The trucks were allowed through the Karnei Abu Salem, Kerem Shalom crossing. The trucks are loaded with supplies for trade, agriculture and transportation sectors. Israel also said it will be pumping limited amounts of industrial fuel for the Gaza power plant, cooking gas, and intends to allow the entry of 7 cement trucks for construction projects run by the UN. Kerem Abu Salem is the only terminal used for the entry of goods and fuel into the coastal region. On Sunday, a Palestinian fisherman from Gaza died of his wounds, according to media sources. He was shot and critically injured by Israeli Navy off the coast of the northwest part of the Gaza Strip last week. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped at least 10 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank. Local sources reported invasions and kidnappings in the cities of Hebron and Bethlehem, as well as Jenin and Nablus cities. Moreover, troops confiscated around 80 computers from two stores in Tulkarem city in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Also near Tulkarem, several Israeli military jeeps and a number of armored bulldozers invaded Faraon town and demolished one home. The army said that the home was destroyed because of its close proximity to the annexation wall illegally built by Israel in the West Bank. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 9th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
The massive international soccer competition, the World Cup, begins this Thursday, June 12th, in Brazil. The competition has been met with strikes, protests, and occupations by workers and the dispossessed. In one of the world's most unequal societies, the Workers' Party government is spending tens of billions of dollars building world-class stadiums, displacing slum dwellers, and ramping up police and the armed forces. At the same time, healthcare, education, and public transportation are suffering from budget cuts. Eduardo Albergaria is an activist in the Party of Socialism and Freedom. He spoke with Labor Radio host Jamie Partridge about the opportunities and challenges in Brazil right now.
What is happening in Brazil right now in the lead up to the World Cup, Eduardo?
So we are, in some days, the World Cup is going to start in Brazil on Thursday, 12. So there is this feeling spread all around the country, a kind of disillusionment about the money that was spent during the World Cup, the social effects that the World Cup has brought to the country. I would say that there is these both feelings, because there is a lot of angry about the World Cup, and of course, soccer, as everybody knows, is a kind of religion in Brazil. Like, people love soccer, and they normally, when there is a World Cup happening, people go crazy. They support the national team really strongly, so it's kind of a nationalist identity too. So these both feelings are inside maybe every Brazilian. There are a lot of people that are angry, and at the same time, most of these people, they love the idea that there is a World Cup. And so
what are people angry about?
People are angry because the costs of the as you said, the cost of the World Cup is huge. 25 billion of our coin has been spent on the games, the biggest cost of all the World Cups in the history until now. People has died during the preparation of the stadiums. 9 workers has died. It's the biggest number on World Cup the history of World Cup preparation too. Especially, I think that there was a huge expectation about what would be the results of the World Cup. When Brazil was chose to host not only the World Cup but the Olympic game too, there was expectation that at least the public transportation would change in the country and the main cities. So
hold on now. The Olympics are also coming to Brazil.
In Rio.
Yeah. To Rio in 2016.
16, yeah.
Okay. So people expected that public transportation at least would be improved.
Yeah, yeah. So they were expecting that the cities would change, would be more beautiful, would be there was new facilities, there would be new sports facilities, schools, or but especially the public transportation would be better. So some years later, after closer to these events, people were thinking that their life would improve, but the opposite is happening, because now all the rents on these cities, the rents skyrocket. So you pay twice, 3 times what you were used to pay. If you go to a restaurant, everything is growing, the prices are growing because of the expectation of the World Cup and the Olympic Games. So your life is not better, it's worse. You know, like people got crazy with that because there was no improvements on the cities. The amount of money that they were expecting to use for public transportation, they cut it by almost a half.
So there are landless and homeless workers movements, people who have been displaced from their homes and who are occupying land near the new stadiums. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a kind of demonstrations that are going on. I think that during this period of the World Cup, the government, they organized a police force that's bigger than, it's the biggest one in the history of the World Cup again. So it's they are going to use all the federal police on during the games. It's 100,000 people, more 57,000 army soldiers and more the local policemen. It will cost $1 billion only if you look for the cost for the security. Actually, they are going to use all this police to try to stop demonstration or make the hinder the demonstration to arrive on the area of the stadiums. Yeah. People will do demonstrations, but with a lot of police, and maybe these demonstrations won't be so big as it were 1 year ago. But nobody know the exact number of how many people is going to the streets. For example, in Brazil, like here, the most poor people pay more tax than the most rich. By the other hand, we have a debt, and half of our budget, the national budget, every year goes to the paying of this debt. That we have never made any auditory on this debt, and Lula and PT didn't do this during their government too. So this money that you pay for the financial system because of the debt goes to the 20,000 most rich families in the country. So it means that our government every year take money for the most poor people and give to the most rich. It's a kind of Robin Hood by the opposite.
Thank you very much, Eduardo Albergaria from the Party of Socialism and Freedom from Brazil. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones and Peter Mazzellis. The producer is Jim Thompson. Special thanks to David Lang and Jamie Partridge. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Definitely stay tuned and tune in tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio. Peace activist Kathy Kelly will speak on Afghanistan beyond the propaganda. Kathy was on the KBOO News this past Friday. You can find that interview on the website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. At 11, host Dan Johnson interviews Portland resident Dennis Creamer, who is a principal subject in Before You Know It, a new landmark documentary about the first out generation of LGBT seniors. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Laura Russell of 23 Sandy Gallery about the show Book Power Redux. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for this community radio station. We can't do it without you. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for a live conversation between KBOO's Jim Thompson and Amy Atwood with the Center for Biological Diversity. They'll talk about the highly secretive arm of the Department of Agriculture known as the Wildlife Service, an organization responsible for the deaths of 2 million native animals over the past year. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Jenka.
Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking with Amy Atwood at the Center for Biological Diversity. Good afternoon, Amy.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I have some questions about this rogue wildlife program. It's called Wildlife Services.
Yes, misnamed agency if there ever was one.
Okay. Why do you say that? Do they not service the wildlife?
Well, actually, this is an agency that's been around for about 100 years, and for much of its history, it existed within the U.S. Department of Interior and was administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. For many years, it was known as Animal Damage Control. Many of your listeners may remember it under that name.
Okay.
But it changed its name in the 1990s to Wildlife Services in response to an increase in criticism that was occurring at that time because of the kinds of activities that it carries out. This year, it has released recently new data documenting the numbers of animals that it killed in fiscal year 2013. And these data show that this program is responsible for the deaths of 4 million animals in this country, 2 million of which were native wildlife. This is a number which reverses what had been a decreasing trend since 2008. Now, you may be asking yourself, why is this agency killing so many animals? Well, it's doing it on behalf primarily of agribusiness interests. A lot of its activity consists of controlling, which is a euphemism for killing predators. A lot of that activity is on public land and on behalf of livestock interests in the American West. But it also carries out such control activities on behalf of other agricultural interests as well. One of the biggest categories of animals tend to be birds that feed on grain in agricultural fields, for example. So this is an agency that is very secretive, which not many people know about. Many people are always surprised to hear about the extent of killing that it carries out. The data that just came out don't tell us why it carried out specifically killings in a particular area, on whose behalf, what problem the killings were supposedly intended to solve, or whether they actually did solve any problems by carrying out the activities that they do.
I see from the press release that some of the animals killed are endangered species.
Yes, that's right. Some of them are, and you know, it's funny because we know that they do kill endangered species and for that matter contribute to the plight of endangered species. They've killed wolverines, for example, Canada lynx, Mexican wolves. Last year, a Wildlife Services employee shot a Mexican wolf, one of the most critically endangered species in North America. He was required to know the difference between a wolf and a coyote and claimed that he was mistaken and thought he was shooting a coyote. You know, so really, you know, this agency has no compunction about killing animals that are imperiled. They really are driven by narrow corporate and livestock grazing interests in the American West.
But this is the federal organization. Here in Oregon, do you have any insight as to their level of their activities? What are they up to?
Well, we have a small amount of information as a result of the new data. For example, we know that they killed 6,582 coyotes in Oregon, fiscal year 2013. And we know that they did that by shooting them from the air, from the ground, from trapping them, and from poisoning them. But we don't really know where or why within the state of Oregon. By contrast, for comparison, in 2012, they killed 4,129 coyotes in Oregon. So they killed 2,453 more coyotes this year than they did last year. And that corresponds with the numbers that we're seeing nationally. In general, we're seeing an increase in the amount of killing overall and an increase in the amount of killing of native animals.
Just doing the numbers in my head, that sounds like a 50% increase.
Yes, I think that's right. They also killed 11 river otters in Oregon last year. That's an increase from the year before. They only killed three in 2012. And they killed 120 cougars in Oregon, which is actually about the same as the year before. And they typically kill around 100 to 140 foxes per year, about 200 black bears a year, and between 40 and 70 bobcats a year in Oregon. And again, we have no idea why.
And there's no oversight. And is there any way to... Oh, I don't know, to gain oversight over this organization or to really find out what they're doing?
Well, we think that there is a lot of room for improvement. And in particular, what we would like to see this agency do is develop a regulatory framework. Now, before your listeners are put off by the legalistic nature of that, let me just explain. Most agencies have a regulatory framework. These are federal rules on the books, which are guided by public sentiment. The public is provided the opportunity to guide the agency's development of that framework. Those rules have to make sure that whatever the agency does is consistent with American values, policies, and laws. This agency or program has been around for about 100 years and has never had any rules. It operates solely under the authority of a very short federal law that was passed in 1931 and a series of policy directives, which are very mysterious, which are just periodically placed on the agency's website, and which are never informed by the public. And so what we would like to see is this agency reformed, and we think that the way it can get there is through a public notice and opportunity to comment on development of a regulatory framework that does ensure that everything that it does is transparent, is subjected to public comment, and is enforceable to ensure that what it does is consistent with our values as a country and not on behalf of private, specific corporate interests, which is unfortunately the status quo. You know, invasive species are a huge problem to biodiversity in North America and are only going to continue to be so as we move forward and the effects of climate change intensify. And so we would like to see, to the extent any federal agency is going to be killing animals on behalf of American citizens, that it do so in a way that's going to help mitigate the effects of invasive species spread and the effects of climate change. So we think that there may be a way for this agency to play that role, but it's going to take a lot of change and reform from what we have today.
Well, this is an arm of the Agriculture Department. In general, would you say that the Agriculture Department has visibility or transparency?
I think it varies, to tell you the truth. I think some aspects of the Agriculture Department are better than others. But this is by far the most secretive federal agency or program that I have ever seen in, you know, 15-plus years of looking at these kinds of programs. It actually started out, as I said earlier, within the Interior Department.
Yes.
And after public scrutiny was increasing in the 1970s, and people were outraged about the methods that this program was using, in particular putting poisons out on the landscape, which, of course, it still does. The Interior Department Secretary at the time, Cecil Andrus, signed a policy directing the program to emphasize the use of non-lethal measures before resorting to lethal measures, especially for predator management. And we're talking about the coyotes and wolves and bears. And in response to that, when the Reagan administration came into office, James Watt rescinded that policy, and the agriculture lobby was able to remove the program from the oversight of the Interior Department and moved it into the Agriculture Department. And we've just seen these problems continue.
I remember James Watt. Yes, James Watts once said that after the last tree is felled, Christ will come back. And that attitude might go a long way to explaining why these organizational changes happened back then in those times. But you mentioned that there was quite a bit of public outcry at that time?
There was, yes.
Is there... would there be any channel today, an appropriate channel today for public outcry and for public participation in this?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing when you look back at the history of this program. There have been times in the past when light has been shown on their activities. And the response of the public is almost always the same, extreme dismay, followed by calls for reform. The way that this usually begins is with investigative journalism. In 1970, Faith McMulty and a guy by the name of Jack Olson did a couple of big exposés about the agency that were published in The New Yorker and Sports Illustrated. And those led almost immediately to congressional hearings and calls for reform, which ultimately culminated in the policy by Cecil Andrus that I mentioned before, which, of course, was subsequently rescinded by James Watt. And so every time we've seen one of these cycles occur, there's been a backlash and a response by the agriculture lobby. This time, again, we see more light being shown on the agency as a result of investigative journalism, primarily by Tom Knutson, who's an investigative journalist with the Sacramento Bee. He published a series of articles about the agency using agency insiders, former employees, and documents. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage. And that work has really led to another cycle of, you know, more information out there about what they're doing, whereas typically they hide what they do, and calls for reform. And so what we think needs to happen here this time is reform from within the executive branch, and in particular through promulgation of a regulatory framework. We think that's probably one of the very few ways that can get us to the place that we need to be, which is a modern program that addresses issues of concern to the public at large and not just to private agribusiness interests. And so we hope that our petition for rulemaking, which we filed in December, will be granted, and that there will be an opportunity for the public to weigh in through comment and guide the agency's development of a binding regulatory framework, which will require transparency, consistency with environmental laws, policies, and the values of the modern American society.
And currently, the Secretary of Agriculture is Tom Vilsack. Is that correct?
That's right.
And would he be a person to contact?
Yes, he would. In fact, we encourage anyone who's concerned about this issue to go to our website, biologicaldiversity.org. And under our current action alerts, you will find a way to tell Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of the Agriculture Department, to grant our petition for rulemaking and do what we've been asking.